The Complete Norse Mythology, adapted by Kevin Crossley Holland, music by Mats Wendt, read by Tom Harris. Part 2. The Song of Rig. Listen, who can hear the sound of grass growing, the sound of wool on a sheep's back growing? Who needs less sleep than a bird? Who is so eagle-eyed that by day and by night he can see the least movement 100 leagues away? Heimdall, Heimdall and Heimdall. But who could tell it was Heimdall, that figure on the seashore, the guardian of the gods, left his horn Gjall safe in Mimir's spring? He left Goldtop, his golden-maned stallion, behind the stable door, and he strode alone across the flaming 3-strand rainbow bridge from Asgard to Midgard. It was spring and time for sowing. The god walked away from the Bifrost over soft green ground, and soon he came to the edge of the earth. All day, as the sun fled west from the wolf, he picked his way along the wavy line where the soil meets the deep sea. At nightfall, Heimdall approached a decrepit turfed hut. The evening air was quite still, but the shack was so rickety that it looked as if it might collapse if the eagle giant Hresvelg gave one flap of his wings. Heimdall knocked and swung open the roughly hewn door. He had to stoop to get under the lintel and over a pack of sacking onto the shining marl floor. It took Heimdall a moment to adjust to the rank, smoky gloom. His eyes smarted, and he retched. Then he made out a trestle table, a bench, more sacking heaped in one corner, a kind of cupboard leaning against a crumbling wall, and in the middle of the room the crouched figures of Ai and Edda, great-grandfather and great-grandmother, facing each other across the fire. "Am I welcome?" asked Heimdall.
"What is your name?" said Ai.
"Rig," said Heimdall.
"You are welcome," said Edda.
So the god joined Ai and Edda. He spoke honeyed words, as he well knew how, and in no time he had won the best position by the fire. From time to time he peered hopefully into the pot hanging over it. After a while, Edda got to her feet. She shuffled to one corner of the stinking hut, poked around, and dumped a loaf of bread on the table. It was not fully leavened and was gritted with husks. Then the old woman uncooked the pot of thin broth and put that on the table, too. The three of them sat on a rough bench and ate what there was to eat. There was one who was by no means satisfied. After their meal, Ai and Edda and their guests were ready to lie down and sleep. Again the gods spoke honeyed words, as well he knew how, and in no time he had won the best position in the middle of the bed, with Ai on one side of him, Edda on the other. For 3 nights the god stayed with great-grandfather and great-grandmother. Then he thanked his host and hostess for their hospitality and went on his way. Every day the 2 stallions, Arvok Early Walker and Alsvid All Swift, dragged the chariot of the sun across the sky, and Day himself rode at ease around the world. The shining mane of his stallion Skinfaxi lit up the earth and heaven. But then night tightened the reins of her mount, Hrimfaxi, and each morning the face of the earth was dewy with foam from his bit. The strength of summer weakened, and the length of the days shortened. So grim winter showed his fist, full of frost and snow and ice and wrestling winds. Soon 9 months had passed, and Edda gave birth to a son. He was sprinkled with water, and his mother swaddled him. He had raven hair, and I and Edda called him Thrall. If Thrall was less handsome than might be desired, he was certainly striking and all of a piece. From the first, his skin was wrinkled, his hands were chapped, his fingers were stubby, and his knuckles were knotted. His face was, in a word, ugly. His back was twisted, and his feet looked too large for him. Nevertheless, Thrall was strong, and as the years passed, he made good use of his strength. Day in, day out, and all night long, he sweated in the forest gathering wood. He bound up bundle after bundle of faggots and carted them home for the burning. When Thrall was a young man, a girl who was his equal in every way came to his hut.
She was bow-legged. The soles of her feet were damp and discolored. Her sunburned arms were peeling, and she had the squashed nose of a boxer. Her name was Thyr, the Drudge. Thrall liked the look of Thyr, and Thyr liked the look of Thrall, and in no time the two of them were sitting by the fire side by side with eyes only for each other. And in a little more they had prepared a bed, a bolster and a hairy blanket, and all evening they sat whispering. That night was not the last that Thrall and Thyr slept together. They had a cluster of contented children. The names of their sons were Fjosnir the cattleman, and Kors Klur, Hrym and Kregi, the shouter and the horsefly, Kefzir the concubine keeper, and stinking Fulnir, Drumb the clot, and Gros de Graldi, the sluggard Drot, and Legjaldi, whose legs were as thick as tree trunks, Lut, who was hunchbacked, and ashen-faced Hosvir. These 10 sons shored up the structure and repaired the fabric of the hut. They spread loads of dung over the land surrounding it. They took their turn as goatherds and at rounding up the pigs, and they all dug for peat. Thrall and Thyr also had daughters. These were Ofish Drumba, Dumpy Kumba, and hefty-thighed Okenkalfa. The best you could say about Aranyefja's nose was that it was homely. There was noisy Yisya, and Ambat the servant. Ikenchasna looked like a peg of oak. Totruipya was clothed in rags, and bony Tronubena had legs as long and skinny as a crane. These were the offspring of Ai and Edda, and from these children came the race of the thralls.
Heimdall continued his journey. He took the shortest way to the next farm and walked up to the door in the blue hour, just as the light was fading. The god knocked and entered. In the middle of the room, a fire flickered, and sitting near it, Heimdall saw Afi and Amma, grandfather and grandmother. Afi had a length of wood laid across his lap and was chipping at it with a knife, shaping a weaver's beam. The knife's blade and the pool of white shavings at his feet gleamed in the gloom. Afi's hair was combed and curled over his forehead. He had a trimmed beard, and his clothes, his leather jacket and breeches, were no less well cut than his hair. Amma was unwinding flax from a distaff, spinning thread. She stretched and she reached, absorbed in her work. She wore a band around her head, and her silver hair was knotted in a bun. She wore a simple frock and a shawl around her shoulders, secured by a handsome clasp.
"Am I welcome?" asked Heimdall.
"What is your name?" asked Afi.
"Rig," said Heimdall.
"You are welcome," said Amma.
So the god joined Afi and Amma. He spoke honeyed words, as he well knew how, and in no time he had won the best position by the fire. From time to time, he peered hopefully into the pot hanging over it. After a while, Amma stopped working and got to her feet. She padded across the room to a stout oak chest and took out a loaf of rye bread and a gob of butter and knives and spoons and arranged them on the table. She dipped a large jug into the vat of beer standing by the door, and then she unhooked the pot of boiled veal and set that on the table too. Then the three of them sat to eat. After their meal, Afi and Amma and their guest were ready to lie down and sleep. The god spoke honeyed words, as well he knew how, and in no time he had won the best position in the middle of the bed, with Afi on one side of him, Amma on the other. For 3 nights the god stayed with grandfather and grandmother. Then he thanked his host and hostess for their hospitality and went on his way. Every day the two stallions dragged the sun across the sky, and Day himself rode at ease around the world. But then Night tightened the reins of her mount, and each morning the face of the earth was dewy with the foam from his bit. Summer's strength weakened, the days shortened. So grim winter showed his fist, full of frost and snow and ice and wrestling winds. Soon 9 months had passed, and Amma gave birth to a son. He was sprinkled with water, and his mother swaddled him. His cheeks were ruddy and he had bright eyes, and Afa and Amma called him Karl. Karl was quick to grow, and he was well-built and strong. In time he learned how to drive oxen with a goad, and how to fasten the share and coulter to a plow. He discovered how to build huts and barns, how to dig the foundations and erect a wooden frame, and lay the turf and pitch a roof. He became a skillful cartwright. When Karl was a young man, his parents found him a wife as much to their liking as to his, the fair daughter of a freeman living nearby. On the appointed day, the bridal party brought her in a wagon to Karl's own farm. She wore a goatskin coat and a veil, and keys jangled at her waist. So Afi and Amma won a daughter-in-law. Her name was Snur. Karl and Snur equipped their farm and arranged things to their liking. They exchanged rings and laid a colorful counterpane on their bed. That place became their place. It became home. Karl and Snur had a cluster of contented children. They called their firstborn Hal, the man, their second Dreng, the warrior, and their other sons were Hold, the landowner, the freeman Thegro, and Smith, who was a master of every craft. Bride was broad-shouldered, and Bondi was a yeoman when he grew up. Bunden Skeggy always wore his beard well trimmed. Bui and Bodi owned a farm and a barn. Bratskeg had a clipped beard too, and like his oldest brother, Seg was manly. Karl and Snur also had 10 daughters. Their eldest they called Snot, the serving woman. There was Brud, the bride, slender Svani and proud Svari, fair Spraki and womanly Fjord. Sprund was as proud as her sister Svari. Vif was born to make a good wife. Faima was bashful, and Restil, the youngest, was as graceful as any woman. These were the children of Karl and Snur, and from these children stemmed the race of peasants. Heimdall continued his journey. He took the shortest way to a hall nearby, and in the late afternoon he strode up to it. Its wide doors faced south, and on one of its posts there was a great wooden ring, intricately patterned. The god knocked and entered. He strode through the long passageway into the hall where the floor was newly strewn with rushes. In this spacious, gracious room, the god saw Fathir and Mothir, father and mother. They sat gazing into each other's eyes, and then they touched just finger ends. Unaware of their visitor standing and watching, Father then busied himself twisting a new bowstring, sharpening arrows, and working at the shape of a carved elm bow shaft itself. Mother, meanwhile, sat and considered her slender arms. She smoothed her pleated chemise and drew the sleeves down to her wrists. Her dress had a train. She wore a flowing blue cape and a charming cap, and on her breast were two oval brooches. This lady was pale-skinned. Her brow was fair, her breast gleaming, and her neck was more white than new-fallen snow. "Am I welcome?" asked Heimdall. "What is your name?" asked Father. "Rig," said Heimdall.
"You were welcome," said Mother.
So the god joined Father and Mother. He spoke honeyed words as he well knew how, and in no time he had won the best position by the fire. Mother lost no time. She held out an embroidered linen cloth and laid it over the table. She brought white loaves of finely ground wheat, bowls worked in silver filigree full to the brim with cheese and onion and cabbage, well-browned pork and horse and lamb, nicely turned partridge and grouse. The pitcher was full not of mead or ale, but wine, and the goblets were made of solid silver. Then the three of them sat to eat. They ate and drank and talked until after dark. After their meal, Father and Mother and their guests were ready to lie down and sleep. The god spoke honeyed words, as he well knew how, and in no time he had won the best position in the middle of the bed. Father slept on one side of him, Mother laid on the other. For 3 nights the god stayed with Father and Mother. Then he thanked his host and hostess for their hospitality and went on his way. Every day the two stallions dragged the sun across the sky, and Day himself rode at ease around the world. But then Night tightened the reins of her mount, and each morning the face of the earth was dewy with foam from his bit. Summer's strength weakened, the days shortened, so grim winter showed his fist, full of frost and snow and ice and wrestling winds. Soon, 9 months had passed, and Mother gave birth to a son. He was sprinkled with water and wrapped in silk. He had fair hair and color in his cheeks, and the look in his glowing eyes was as grim as a snake. Fathir and Mother called him Jarl. Jarl was quick to master skills. He learned how to hold and hoist a shining shield and to wield a lance. Like his father, he twisted bowstrings and shaped bow shafts and loosed quivering arrows. He rode. He unleashed hounds. He learned the art of swordplay and could swim across sounds. One day, unannounced, the god walked out of the forest of slender silver birches that stood near the hall. He strode to the building and found Jarl there, sitting alone.
"Jarl," he said.
"You are welcome," said Jarl.
"I've brought you a gift," said the god.
He showed Jarl a bundle of staves carved with signs and colored red. Jarl stared at them. He had never seen such things before.
"These are the runes. This is the magic that Allfather learned when he hung on the tree Yggdrasil."
Jarl looked at the god, then the runes, then at the god again.
"Do you know the words against pain of the mind, pain of the heart, pain of the body?"
Jarl shook his head slowly.
"Do you know the words that put water on a fire? Do you know the words that put the sea to sleep?"
All that day the god explained the secret meaning of the runes to Jarl, and Jarl felt excited and ready. He thought all his life had been waiting for this moment.
"I have one more thing to tell you," said the god as the light failed.
"What is that?" asked Jarl.
"My son." The god took Jarl into his arms. "You are my son," he said. And he explained how he had visited the hall so long before. "You are my son, and as I am Rig the King, so you will be Rig the King. Now is the time to win land, to win great age-old halls and command a host of followers."
The god looked piercingly at Jarl, his son, who turned on his heel and walked out of the gleaming hall into the darkness. Jarl did not need to be told twice. He thought his father's words explained to him what he had always felt but could not name. He was filled with a sense of release and purpose. At once Jarl left the hall where he had lived since the day of his birth. He rode through the dark forest and over passes between frosty, forbidding crags, and in a place difficult of access he established his own hall. He gathered a group of loyal retainers.
Jarl shook his spear and brandished his shield. He spurred his horse and dealt death blows with his sword.
He brought his followers to battle and stained the soil red. He slew warriors and won land. Before long, Jarl owned no less than 18 halls. He won great wealth and was generous to his retainers. He gave them finger rings and armbands, both of gold. He gave them precious stones, and he gave them horses lean and fleet of foot. In time, Jarl sent messengers over the boggy ground to the hall of the chieftain Hersir, and there on Jarl's behalf they asked for the hand of his daughter, Irna. She was fair-haired and long-fingered, and accomplished at whatever she put her mind to. Hersir was delighted. After Irna had made proper preparation, the messengers escorted her to Jarl's hall wearing a wedding veil, and she and Jarl lived most happily together. Jarl and Irna had a cluster of contented children. They called their firstborn Búr, the son, and their second Barn, the child. There was Jod, the child, and Athel, the offspring. Arvi was an heir, and Mog, another son. There were Nid and Nidjung, the descendants, Sven, the boy, the kinsman Kund. The youngest was Conn, a nobly born son.
Soon all the boys learned to play and swim. As they grew older, they tamed beasts and made circular shields, shaped shafts, and shook spears. But Conn the Young learned from his father the runes, the age-old meanings. In time, he was able to blunt a sword blade and put the sea to sleep. He understood the language of the birds. He could quell flames and quieten cares, the raging mind and aching heart of an unhappy man. He had the strength of 8 men. Conn and Rig Jarl shared their secret understanding of the runes, and Conn was even more subtle and wise than his father. He believed it would be his right, too, to be called Rig the King, and he soon won that right. One day, Conn went riding in the gloomy, dark forest. Now and then, he reined in his mount and loosed an arrow at a luckless bird. Other birds he lured from their perches and listened to them. A crow sat on a branch over Conn's head.
"Conn," it croaked, "why do you spend your time seducing birds to talk to you? You would do better to set out on your stallion and show daring in battle."
Conn listened carefully to the crow's counsel. The darkness seemed to fall back from the clearing where he stood and to wait in the wings.
"Who has halls more noble than yours?" continued the crow. "Who have won riches greater than yours? Golden jewels and precious ornaments?"
Conn did not answer. He clenched his fists.
"Who are more skilled than you in steering their ships across the reach of the sea and the stinging salt spray?"
Still, Conn did not answer.
"Dan and Damp, Dan and Damp, Dan and Damp," sang the crow.
It looked sideways at Conn.
"They know what it means to temper their weapons with the blood of enemies."
Here the song ends. It is incomplete. The Mead of Poetry. When the Aesir and the Vanir had made a truce and settled terms for a lasting peace, every single god and goddess spat into a great jar. This put the seal on their friendship, and because the Aesir were anxious that no one should forget it, even for one moment, they carried off the jar, and out of the spittle they fashioned a man. His name was Kvasir. He was so steeped in all matters and mysteries of the 9 worlds since fire and ice first met in Ginnungagap that no god nor man, nor giant nor dwarf, ever regretted putting him to a question or asking his opinion. And wherever Kvasir went, news of his coming went before him. When he reached some remote farm or hamlet, sewing and salting and scything and swordplay were laid aside. Even children stopped chattering and listened to his words. What was his secret? It was as much in his manner as in his mind of understanding. Questions of fact he answered with simple facts. But to ask Kvasir for his opinion, "What shall I say? What do you think? What shall I do?" did not always mean getting a direct answer. Sitting back in his ill-fitting clothes, as often as not with his eyes closed, he would listen to recitals of problems and sorrows with a kind, grave, blank face. He took in and set everything in a wider frame. He never intruded or insisted, rather he suggested. Often enough he answered a question with another question. He made gods and men, giants and dwarfs, feel that they had helped to answer their own questions. The stories of Kvasir's wisdom soon reached the ears of the most unpleasant pair of brothers, the dwarves Fialar and Galar. Their interest soon turned to envy, and their envy to energy, for they could not admire anything without wanting it for themselves. They asked Kvasir to feast with them, the large gathering of dwarves in their caves beneath the earth, and it was as his custom Kvasir accepted. The table was a long slab of uneven rock, the floor was grit, and the wall hangings were dripping stalactites. The talk was mainly of profit and loss and petty revenge. The food, however, and the tableware, all made of hammered gold, were rather more pleasing. After the feast, Fialar and Galar asked Kvasir for a word in private. Kvasir followed them into a gloomy chamber, and that was a mistake. The 2 dwarves had knives hidden in their sleeves,
and at once they buried them in the wise man's chest. His blood spurted out of his body, and Fjallar and Galar caught it all in two large jars, Son and Bone, and a cauldron named Odrarir. Kvasir's heart stopped pumping, and his drained white body lay still on the ground. When, after a while, the Aesir sent a messenger to ask after Kvasir, the two dwarves sent back word that he had unfortunately choked on his own learning, because there was no one in the Nine Worlds well-informed enough to compare and compete with him. But Fjallar and Galar were delighted with what they had done. They poured honey into the jars and cauldron filled with Kvasir's blood, and with ladles stirred the mixture. The blood and honey formed a sublime mead. Whoever drank it became a poet or a wise man. The dwarves kept this mead to themselves. No one else tasted it. No one even heard about it. One day the dwarf brothers entertained two gruesome guests, the giant Gilling and his wife. It was not long before they began to quarrel, and Fjallar and Galar became more and more spiteful and full of hate. They suggested that Gilling might enjoy the sea breeze, and each taking an oar, rowed far out into the ocean surrounding Midgard. Then the dwarves rammed their boat into a slimy, half-submerged rock. Gilling was alarmed and gripped one gunwale. His alarm was well-founded. The boat floundered and capsized. Gilling was unable to swim, and that was the end of Gilling. The two dwarves cheerfully righted their craft and rowed home singing. Fjallar and Galar described what had happened to Gilling's wife.
"An accident," said Fjallar.
"If only he'd been able to swim," Galar said sadly. Gilling's wife wept and wept, sitting in their cave. The two dwarves did not like the feel of the tepid water washing around their ankles.
"I've an idea," whispered Fjallar to his brother. "Find a millstone and go and wait above the entrance to the cave."
Galar got up and went outside, and Fjallar asked the giantess,
"Would it help if you looked out at sea? I could show you the place where he drowned."
Gilling's wife stood up sobbing, and Fjallar stepped aside for her as it befits a host. And when the giantess stepped out into the daylight, Galar dropped the millstone onto her head.
"I was sick of her wailing," said Fjallar.
When Gilling and his wife did not return to Jotunheim, their son Suttung set out in search of them. He looked at the dwarves' dismal faces and listened to their lengthy tales, and then he seized both of them by the scruff of their necks. Holding one in each hand, a pair of danglers, he angrily waded a mile out to sea until it was too deep even for him. Then Suttung dumped Fjallar and Galar on a skerry, a sopping rock standing just clear of the water.
"It's much too far for you to swim," he said. "Much too far. So when the tide rises..."
Fjallar looked at Galar, and both brothers grimaced.
"We've a suggestion," said Fjallar.
"Since it has come to this," said Galar, "we're willing to offer you our greatest treasure."
Then Fjallar described the mead, both its origin and power, with a wealth of words.
"Give us our lives," said Galar, "and we'll give it to you."
"Agreed," said Suttung.
So Suttung took the two dwarves back to their cave, and since they clearly had no choice, they handed over Kvasir's blood. The giant stumped back to Jotunheim, carrying Son in one hand and Bodin in the other, and Odrarir under his arm. He took the precious liquid to the mountain Hnitbjorg, where he lived. Suttung hewed a new chamber out of the rock in the heart of the mountain and hid the three crocs in it. And he told his daughter Gunnlod that she had one duty.
"Guard this mead by day and guard it by night."
Unlike the dwarf brothers, Suttung was boastful about his treasure. So it was not long before the gods learned about the divine mead and heard how it had fallen into Suttung's unholy hands. Odin himself elected to go to Jotunheim and bring the mead back to Asgard. The masked god, the one-eyed god, god of the gods, disguised himself as a giant of a man and called himself Bulverk, worker of evil. He crossed the river that divided Asgard and Jotunheim and strode across a desert of shifting gray grit where nothing, not even a grass blade, could take root. Bulverk came to a curtain of mountains. He hurried over a snowy pass and at last walked down into a narrow green valley. 9 thralls were working in the sloping field,
men from Midgard with a taste for adventure and handsome reward. They were scything the succulent grass with long, slow sweeps and seemed very weary.
"Who is your master?" Bolvirk asked one thrall who had stopped work entirely.
"Balgi," said one thrall.
"Balgi?"
"Suttung's brother," the thrall said. "The giant who guards Kvasir's blood."
"Shall I sharpen your scythe?" asked Bolvirk affably.
The thrall was rather quick to agree to this, and when Bolvirk drew a whetstone from his belt and began to put a new edge on the scythe, the other thralls crowded around in the hope that he would hone their scythes too. Bolvirk obliged, and the thralls all said that their scythes had never been quite as sharp before. They complained that the giant Balgi was too hard a taskmaster. They pointed to an acre of grass still uncut that lay before them. Coming to the point, the thralls asked whether they could buy the hone.
"I might think about selling it," said Bolvirk, "but only to one man and only to the one, if there is such a man here, who will feast me tonight in the manner to which I'm accustomed."
The air was filled with shouts of agreement. "Yes," the thralls shouted. "Yes, me, I will. Here, all right. I'm your man. Done. Agreed. Your hand on it." Bolvirk looked at them with his one eye. He smiled grimly. Then he threw the whetstone into the air. In the sun it glinted, it looked like silver. The thralls gasped. They raised their scythes and ran, all of them eager to be under the whetstone when it fell. It seemed to hang in the air, so high had Bolvirk tossed it. The thralls jostled. They stepped backwards. They suddenly swung round, and in the end, in their confusion, they had all slit each other's throats. The nine of them lay in the long grass they had just cut. Still smiling grimly, Bolvirk caught the whetstone, tucked it into his belt, and walked back the way he had come. The sun dawdled, and so did Allfather. Not until nearly midnight did he come down from the mountains again and make his way to Balgi's farm. He said his name was Bolvirk and explained that he had been walking all day. Then he asked Balgi if he could give him some kind of a meal and let him stay overnight in one of the huge barns near to the farmhouse.
"A fine time to ask," said Balgi abruptly.
Bolvirk looked pained and asked Balgi what was wrong.
"All my farmhands have been killed, that's what's wrong," Balgi said.
Balgi banged his fist on a trestle table, a blow so powerful that it would have flattened a man's head.
"All nine of them, and how can I hope to find any more at this time of year?"
"I've an idea," said Bolvirk. "You can see I'm strong, very strong. I can take on the work of nine men."
Balgi looked Bolvirk up and down and smiled in disbelief, thinking Bolvirk was a hollow boaster.
"And if I agreed, what wages would you ask?"
"Only this," said Bolvirk. "One drink of Suttung's mead."
Balgi sniffed and shook his head.
"I may be strong," said Bolvirk, "but to be a poet, that's the finest calling."
"That mead has nothing to do with me," said Balgi. "My brother has it in his safe keeping, and no one except Gunnlod has ever seen a drop of it. That's how things are."
"Well," said Bolvirk, "those are my terms."
Balgi shrugged his shoulders, and so Bolvirk got up to leave.
"I can talk to Suttung," said Balgi.
He had little love for his brother, but he felt sure that in any case Bolvirk would never be strong enough to keep his part of the bargain.
"Work for me this summer, and I'll tell my brother how you helped me out. That's the best I can do."
"How far can I trust you?" said Bolvirk.
"You'll see," said Balgi.
For as long as the long days, Bolvirk worked for Balgi. As the sun climbed out of the east, Bolvirk walked to the green fields, still thick with the honeydew that fell every night from the branches of Yggdrasil. All day he worked under the bright skull of the sky. He worked while the sun hurried west until it seemed to hang, blood red, on the western skyline. Balgi was amazed that Bolvirk was as good as his boast, and seemed to need so little rest, he thought now that Bolvirk must be more than merely human. At the end of the summer, Bolvirk asked Balgi for his wages. They went together to find Suttung at Hnitbjörg, and Balgi told his brother how Bolvirk had helped him, and asked him for some of the divine mead.
"Never," said Suttung, "not a drop." Well, said Bulwark, as soon as he was alone with Baugi, I hope you're not going to accept Sutug's answer. I've worked for you all summer.
I've kept my promise, Baugi said.
Why should he have it all for himself, said Bulwark. Don't you fancy a mouthful, Baugi? Since your brother won't part with the mead willingly, let us see if we can trick him out of it.
Impossible, said Baugi. Do you know where it is hidden?
He was rather nervous of Sutung, but he was also rather nervous of Bulwark. Bulwark pulled an auger called Rati out of his belt and told the giant that with it he might be able to drill a hole into the mountain.
This is the least you can do in return for my work.
Baugi took the auger and pressed the shank against the sheer rock face of the mountain Gipbjorg, and with both hands he turned the handle. He wondered how to get rid of the troublesome farmhand as he wound and wound, and the auger sank into the mountain.
There, exclaimed the giant, right through!
He withdrew the drill and wiped his brow. Bulwark peered with his one eye into the dark passage left by the auger. Then he filled his lungs and blew fiercely into it. A shower of rock chippings blew back into his face, and Bulwark knew that Baugi had not, after all, cored the mountain.
Where are you trying to cheat me? He said.
The giant said nothing. He drilled further into the mountain, vowing silently to dispose of Bulwark as soon as he could. When Baugi withdrew the auger once more, and Bulwark blew down the hole a second time, all the loose chippings were carried forward on the tide of air. Then Bulwark knew that the giant had bored right into the room at the heart of Nitbjorg. At once he turned himself into a snake and writhed into the auger hole. Baugi stabbed at Bulwark with the point of the auger, but he was not quick enough. The snake was already halfway down the passage on his way to Gudlod and the Divine Mead. As soon as he reached the stronghold, Bulwark changed himself back into a giant of a man, one-eyed but handsome, and stood in front of Sutung's daughter. Gudlod was sitting on a stool of solid gold, and at the sight of Bulwark, Sutung's stern warning that she should guard the mead flew right out of her head. She was sorry not to have company. She sat and listened to Bulwark's beguiling words and songs. She wrapped her arms around him. For 3 days they talked and laughed, and for 3 nights they slept together. In the silent cave under Hnitbjorg, the heartless father of the gods made love to the spellbound daughter of Sutung. Then Gudlod was drunk with passion and ready to give Bulwark whatever he desired. He asked for 3 draughts of Kvasir's blood, and Gudlod took his hand and led him to the mead. With his first draught, Bulwark emptied Odrarir. With his second draught, Bodin. With his third draught, Son. The father of the gods held all of the divine mead in his mouth. Then Odin turned himself into an eagle, flapped down the passage out of Hnitbjorg, and headed for Asgard. Sutung saw him, and at once murmured the magic words known only to those who have drunk divine mead. Gods and angels and men and dwarves saw a dark sight, one eagle pursuing another toward the kingdom of Asgard. The Aesir quickly brought out jars and bowls and laid them side by side so that they covered the entire courtyard just inside the great wall of Asgard. Anxiously they watched as Sutung came closer and closer to Odin. The distant rustle became a whir, and the whir a terrible flapping and beating of wings. There was only a wingspan between the two birds. Then the eagle Odin dived in over the wall and spat the mead into the crocs assembled beneath him. In his haste to escape Sutung, Odin could not help letting some mead spill outside the wall, but it was so little that the gods were not bothered about it. They said that anyone who wanted it could have it, and that became the poetaster's portion. Sutung shrieked and wheeled away and shrieked again. He had lost through cunning what he had won through force, and there was nothing he could do. And the gods? They had lost wise Kvasir, witness to the friendship between the Aesir and the Vanir. But because of the cunning of the Allfather, they had won back his blood. Once more, Odin drank some of the precious mead, and from time to time he offered a draught to one of the Aesir, or even a man or two in Midgard. He offered them the gift of poetry.
Loki's Children and the Binding of Fenrir.
The mother of Sleipnir was also the father of three appalling children. Not content with his faithful wife, Sigyn, Loki sometimes took off for Jotunheim. The long-legged god hurried east and spent days and nights on end with the giantess Angerboda. Loki and Angerboda had three monstrous offspring. The eldest was the wolf Fenrir. The second was Jormungand, greatest of serpents. And the third was a daughter called Hel. Even in a crowd of 1,000 women, Hel's looks were quite likely to single her out. Her face and neck and shoulders and breasts and arms and back, they were all pink. But from her hips down, every inch of Hel's skin looked decayed and greenish black. Her expression was always the same, gloomy and grim. When the gods heard that the father of lies had also fathered these children, they were filled with alarm. They discussed what to do about them at the Well of Urd, and the three Norns gave them little encouragement.
"Their mother is evil," said Urd.
"But their father is worse," Verdandi said. "Expect nothing from them but the worst," said Skald. "Expect them to harm you and endanger you. They will be in at the kill." And so the gods agreed that Loki's children must be captured. At Odin's behest, a group of gods crossed into Jotunheim by night. They burst into Angerboda's hall and gagged and bound her before she had even rubbed her eyes. Then they kidnapped her children and carried them back to Asgard. Odin was in no doubt as to what should be done with the serpent. He picked up Jormungand and hurled him into the ocean surrounding Midgard, the world of men. He hurled through the air, smashed through the iron face of the water, and sank to the sea bottom. There he lived, and there he grew. Jormungand, the Midgard serpent, grew so thick and so long that he encircled the whole world and bit his own tail. Odin was just as sure what to do about the serpent's sister. He took one look at Hel and hurled her out of Asgard too. He threw her into the mist and darkness of Niflheim, the world beneath the worlds. And as she fell, she heard Odin's decree that she should look after the dead, all those in the nine worlds who died of illness or old age, the condition being that she would share out whatever food she had with whomever came to her. Hel made herself a home. Beyond the sheer rock, dropped to destruction, she built huge walls around her estate. Her hall, Eljudnir, home of the dead, lay within it, behind a massive pair of gates. Hel's manservant and maidservant, Ganglati and Ganglot, moved around so slowly that it was not easy to tell whether they were moving at all. Her plate was called Hunger, and her knife Famine. Her bed was Sick Bed, and the bed hangings Glimmering Misfortune. Odin thought it would be best if the gods themselves kept an eye on Fenrir. He seemed no different than any other wolf, and all the gods agreed that there would be no harm in letting him roam around the green and golden fields of Asgard. Even so, of all the gods, only Tyr, son of Odin, was brave enough to face Fenrir alone and give him great joints, flesh and gristle and bone, to keep him quiet. The gods were not slow to change their minds about Fenrir when they saw him growing larger day by day. And when Urd, Skald, and Verdandi renewed their warnings and said that the wolf would cause Odin's death, their alarm became far greater. They agreed that since they could not kill the wolf then and there, and stain the sanctuary of Asgard with his evil blood, they must catch and fetter him. Then the gods made a powerful chain of iron links, and they called it Lading. Several of them went up to Fenrir, showed him the chain, and asked, "Are you as strong as this?" The wolf inspected Lading.
"It's certainly strong, but I'm certainly stronger,"
was all he had to say as he let the gods wind the chain around his neck and body and legs, until there was only a small length for them to hold on to.
"Finished," snarled the wolf.
He planted his massive paws well apart, filled his lungs with air, and then flexed every muscle in his body. Lading's links at once sprang apart, and the gods sprung back alarmed. The gods lost no time in making another chain. This was called Dromi, and it was twice as strong as Lading. The links were larger than those of the largest anchor chain. No men could have even moved them. "If you can break this chain," the gods told Fenrir, "you will be known for your strength throughout the nine worlds." Fenrir looked at Dromi. He thought it looked immensely strong. But then he thought, that he too had grown even stronger since he had snapped lading.
No one wins fame without taking a risk, was all he had to say as the gods wound the vast chain around his neck and body and legs. Finished, snarled the wolf. He shook so that there was a terrible clinking and clanking and grating. He rolled over and arched his back and banged the chain against the ground. He tightened his muscles until they were as hard as the iron links of Dromi. He stood up again and dug his paws into the earth and strained and strained. And all at once, Dromi snapped. It shattered into hundreds of separate links. The shrapnel flew in every direction. After this, the gods were frightened. They thought they might fail to fetter Fenrir.
But if anyone can make a fetter that will not break, Odin said, the dwarves can.
And so he sent off Bright Skirnir, Frey's messenger, to the world of the Dark Elves, Svartalfheim. Skirnir went down under Midgard through gloomy, dark, twilight grottos. There he found Gnar and Nine, and Neeping and Dine, and Bifur and Bafur and Bomber and Nori and hundreds of others, each one as horrible as the next, and promised them gold and more gold if they could make a fetter for Fenrir. In the gloom, the dwarves' eyes gleamed like glowworms. They whispered and schemed and set to work. They made a fetter as smooth and supple as a silk ribbon, and they called it Gleipnir. When he returned to Asgard, Skirnir was thanked by all the gods for going on this mission.
But what is it made of? Asked Odin, fingering the fetter.
Six things, said Skirnir. The sound a cat makes when it moves, a woman's beard, the roots of a mountain, the sinews of a bear, the breath of a fish, and a bird's spittle.
The gods were both astonished and skeptical at Gleipnir's power.
If you doubt it, as I doubted it, said Skirnir, remember that cunning of the dwarves. After all, have you ever thought why a cat makes no noise when it moves, and why a woman has no beard? You can never prove that a mountain has no roots, but many things that seem not to exist are simply in the dwarves' safe keeping. Then a large group of gods approached Fenrir for the third time. They invited him to go out with them to the Isle of Lyngvi, in the middle of the lake, and Svartnir. There the gods produced the silk ribbon of Gleipnir. They showed it to Fenrir and challenged him to test his strength against it.
It's a little stronger than it seems, said one.
It's as well woven as the words of a good poem, said another.
But you, Fenrir, you'll be able to break it.
The wolf looked at Gleipnir.
This ribbon is so slender that I'll win no fame for snapping it.
He eyed Gleipnir again.
If, on the other hand, cunning and magic have gone into its making, then slender as it looks, you can keep it for yourselves. I'm not having it wound around my legs.
Before this, said one god, you've prized apart massive iron fetters. You'll have no bother with this band.
And if by chance you're unable to break it, said another, we'll set you free again. You can trust us.
Fenrir showed his teeth, and the gods did not like the look of them.
If you're able to fetter me, he snarled, it will be a long time before I can hope for any help from you.
Fenrir prowled right round the group of gods.
I don't want to be bound with that ribbon, but neither do I want to be accused of cowardice. So while the others bind me, let one of you put his hand in my mouth as a token of your good faith.
Tyr looked one by one at all the gods in that company. All the gods there looked at each other and said nothing, wondering what to do. Then Tyr slowly lifted his right arm and put his hand in Fenrir's mouth. At once the other gods wound Gleipnir round and round the wolf's neck and body and legs until it was all used up.
Fenrir began to struggle against it. He tried to kick and shrug and shake and jerk and roll, but the more he strained, the tighter Gleipnir became. Then Fenrir snarled and clamped his teeth. Tyr, bravest of the gods, twisted and cried out, unable to bear such pain.
The other gods laughed. They knew that Fenrir was bound at last. They all laughed except Tyr. He lost his hand. The gods fixed the large chain called Gelgja to the end of the silken ribbon. They passed the end of this chain through the hole in a huge boulder called Gjoll.
looped it back, and secured it to itself. The gods drove Gyul a mile down into the earth. Then they found the vast rock, Thviti, and dropped that atop of Gyul to fasten it. Fenrir shook and wrestled. He grated his teeth and gulped and opened his blood-stained jaws immensely wide. Then one of the gods drew his sword. He drove the point hard into the roof of Fenrir's mouth and rammed the hilt against his lower jaw. The wolf was gagged. Fenrir was gagged and Fenrir was bound. His howls were terrible, and slaver streamed from his jaws. It ran from the middle of the island into the lake of Amsvatnir and was called Vom, the river of expectation. And just as the Midgard serpent waits at the bottom of the ocean coiled round the world, just as Hel waits in Niflheim, surrounded by corpses and swirling death mist, so, gagged and bound on Lyngvi, Fenrir lies and waits for Ragnarok.